Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. Hitting another quick read today. This one is by Nick Carter. We've done a couple of articles by Nick Carter in the past, maybe one, maybe two. I can't remember exactly which ones. But always really fun stuff from Nick Carter. We did Visions of Bitcoin very recently. That was his. But today we will be hitting his rebuttal to the Washington Post article. And his work is titled, this is another Medium post, titled "Media Coverage of Bitcoin is Still a Total Disaster." And linking to the Washington Post article in question is titled "Bitcoin is Still a Total Disaster." Nick Carter does a pretty good job of hitting all the main points of the Washington Post article, so I'm not going to go into anything specific with that article outside of exactly what Nick Carter talks about. But without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into Nick Carter's piece, "Media Coverage of Bitcoin is Still a Total Disaster." I'm fed up with journalists who are either ignorant or unwilling to learn about cryptocurrency, holding forth on its perceived weaknesses. However, there isn't enough time in the day to rebut all of their nonsense, so I have to be selective. Here I'm going to expose the Washington Post wonk blog piece for the nonsensical ramble that it is. Below is a link to the article in question. In short, it relies on mistaken assumptions to paint a misleading picture of the world. Let me engage with some of the claims made in the piece. Claim: currencies are meant to be stable. Quote: there's one thing a currency is supposed to do that Bitcoin never has, that's maintain a stable value. End quote. This assumes that Bitcoin is a currency, and that the definition of currency is normative. X should do Y, as opposed to descriptive. Things of type X have the qualities Y and Z. I would classify Bitcoin the protocol as a complete monetary system, and Bitcoin the unit of value as a commodity money, which has the potential to become a gold-like reserve currency. Commodities fluctuate. That's what they do. Additionally, currency isn't meant to maintain a stable value. Monetary policy is used for a variety of macroeconomic objectives, including targeting GDP growth, unemployment rates, inflation, trade balances, and more. If stability was the objective, the Fed would target 0% inflation rather than the 2% that it currently does. Am I moving the goalposts? It's a matter of figuring out how Bitcoin is used and what it was intended for. I'm not sure Satoshi ever defined Bitcoin as a currency. He defines it as a system for electronic transactions, a peer-to-peer version of electronic cash, and an electronic payment system. He envisions Bitcoin as a protocol and a bearer digital unit of value. The interpretation of Bitcoin as a currency is mostly inferred by outsiders imposing a particular view upon the protocol. Unburdened by priors, a neutral analyst would probably describe it as something similar to gold. In fact, Satoshi described proof of work with reference to gold mining, and later discussed Bitcoin as analogous to a scarce, inert, infinitely portable metal which might develop a monetary premium. He clearly saw it as a gold-like commodity which would recapture those same properties in the digital realm, and I think this the most fitting interpretation of the system. Claim: Bitcoin was designed with volatility in mind. Quote: why has Bitcoin's price been so up and down? Well, part of it is that it was designed that way. End quote. This is an odd rewrite of history, or more charitably, a very strange interpretation of Bitcoin's purpose. The impossible trinity tells that it's impossible to have free capital flow, sovereign monetary policy, and a fixed exchange rate all at the same time. Bitcoin was designed with sovereign monetary policy and a free flow of capital. No one underwrites or backs Bitcoin, so it cannot be pegged to a real-world basket of goods. That's the same with gold. Both have emergent monetary premia. This can't be planned for, it just so happened that way. Needless to say, Satoshi didn't design Bitcoin to be unstable. He wanted to solve the problem of double spins with digital cash such that it didn't rely on a single validator. Its volatility is an emergent property, not a design objective. Claim: validating transactions is the source of its computational overhead. Quote, the problem with a decentralized network was that the only way to do that would be for every member of that network to keep a record of every Bitcoin transaction there had ever been. That way they knew who had Bitcoin to spend, which would require a lot of computing power. End quote. This is a common misconception. Proof of work and mining ensures that the network deterministically converges to a shared history without any subjectivity or off-chain coordination. The fact that the minted units have value means that miners are incentivized to behave appropriately in the short and medium term. And the fact that those units are worth X dollars means that miners will pay anything up to X dollars to obtain them. This is the source of the large quantities of computing power allocated to the network. The combination of efficient mining hardware and large amounts of value at stake. The validation and record keeping is behavior conducted by full nodes, not miners. The cost of maintaining the Bitcoin data store is an externality pushed onto full nodes through bandwidth and storage costs. This is not the job of miners. This is a basic distinction lost on many. Claim: Bitcoin's volatility is unnatural. Quote, but even this inbuilt volatility doesn't fully explain why Bitcoin has been on such a roller coaster ride. Something else must be going on, and that something is plain old manipulation. End quote. Volatility isn't inbuilt, it's a feature of every non-pegged economic asset. The post should keep its fragilista thinking to itself. Plain old manipulation? You really mean to tell me you think a $100 billion network was manipulated into existence? Is it so difficult to accept that Bitcoin provides a differentiated, useful service to millions of people worldwide, and that's why it has value? Does the Post have any proof that markets are not long-term efficient? If so, they have a Nobel Prize in economics to collect. Quote, what seems to still be happening in 2018 with various pump-and-dump schemes, end quote. Don't conflate Bitcoin with random worthless altcoins. There is a lot of pump-and-dump in this industry, but it is infeasible in the extreme to pump-and-dump Bitcoin. If you're part of a pump-and-dump group, you target alts in the $50 to $300 million range, not Bitcoin. Claim: Bitcoin is only used as a currency due to the wealth effect. Quote, the first is that what makes Bitcoin work as a way to transfer things, the expectation that its price will keep rising. End quote. That's not what makes it work. It works as a way to transfer things because it's a pretty good distributed clearinghouse for value. If Bitcoin was stagnant at $1,000 for the next 10 years, it would remain a good way to transfer things. During the 18-month bear market that began in January 2014, people still used Bitcoin. In fact, usage grew consistently the entire time. Bitcoin offers transactors a rival benefit, something they cannot find anywhere else. It is unique among cryptocurrencies as it boasts the best reliability, uptime, dedicated track record, and protocol developer community. It is unique among monetary assets because it offers properties not instantiated by gold or the US dollar. There's a reason people choose Bitcoin. Claim: Bitcoin's deflationary characteristics mean that no one uses it. Quote, Why spend $100 worth of Bitcoin today if you think it's going to be worth $1,000 in a not too distant tomorrow? You wouldn't, and people aren't. End quote. Shameless plug. I urge you to consult my website, coinmetrics.io. We make this data free and available so anyone can use it. Conservatively, Bitcoin saw $2.5 billion in on-chain transaction volume yesterday. That's omitting all the off-chain transactions that occur on Open Dimes, on second-layer networks like Lightning, and internally at Zappo and at Coinbase. In the last year, Bitcoin routinely hosted the transfer of $2 billion a day, up to a peak of about $16 billion a day. That's a lot of fake transactions. The anticipated response to this is from the skeptic is that on-chain volumes are just a clearinghouse for the multitude of exchanges worldwide, or simply a way for individuals to access the altcoin casino. The former is probably true. We have good evidence that Bitcoin is mostly an industrial network dominated by exchanges and power users rather than one that caters to end users. Using that rough heuristic that industrial users tend to batch transactions, we can see that 30 to 40% of the network is industrialized in this manner. There's nothing wrong with this. It simply means that Bitcoin acts as a decentralized global settlement network for a number of endpoints that connect it to everyday economic systems with which users transact at the individual level. This is pretty radical. A decentralized, neutral, untamperable central bank that settles flows on a continuous basis between a global network of smaller banks, exchanges, merchants, and custodians. What a concept. As for the Bitcoin as an on-ramp to the altcoin casino view, if this were true, then Bitcoin would have cratered along with altcoins as they fell 80 to 90% over the last 6 months. However, Bitcoin has shown great strength against altcoins during the bear market. If you look at any index, Bitcoin has regained dominance. This pokes holes in the story that it is only used for access to altcoin pump and dumps. For context, here's the Bletchley Total Market Index, quoted in Bitcoins since December. Ever since the contraction began in January, Bitcoin has strengthened against the rest of the crypto asset market. You wouldn't expect this if Bitcoin was only a vehicle for speculation on other cryptocurrencies. Clearly, there is demand for Bitcoin in its own right. Claim: Bitcoin is illiquid and hence manipulated. Quote: This lack of liquidity makes it pretty easy for a few fraudsters to push the price up quite a bit, end quote. This isn't the case and relies on a flawed reading of the Tether situation. Fundamentally, Bitcoin is quite liquid. It has huge volumes on listed exchanges and probably the same amount again on OTC providers like Cumberland, Circle, Genesis, and Octagon. Even if you subtract all Tether volume and all volume from synthetic exchanges like BitMEX, and all swaps and futures volume from the CME and CBOE, you have robust volumes. The market for Bitcoin to fiat, on the right in the chart below, is also quite liquid. Begin chart. Shows the exchange volume on the left at just over $1 billion with percentages broken down on Binance, HitBTC, Kraken, GDAX, and others, and then the fiat volume at $129 million, broken into the US dollar, the euro, the British pound, and the Canadian dollar, and other. End chart. If you look at the market for fully regulated futures exchanges, the picture is sunny. Yesterday, 7,077 contracts were traded at the CME, equivalent to $215 million. The liquidity picture is strong and improving. Claim: Bearer assets are dangerous and illegal. Quote: There's a reason, after all, why Bitcoin has attracted so many scammers. All its transactions are irreversible. End quote. You have to take the bad with the good. It's a digital bearer asset, which is completely new. Of course people want to scam with it. It's the best money ever invented. That US dollar is never used by scammers, right? Quote: All of which is to say that if you steal a Bitcoin, you get to keep a Bitcoin. End quote. If you earn a Bitcoin, you get to keep a Bitcoin. If you mine a Bitcoin, you get to keep a Bitcoin. Strong property rights are a hell of a thing. This is just an incentive to build more secure wallet and custody software. We're halfway there already. Claim: Bitcoin still relies on a trusted set of intermediaries. Quote: Bitcoiners think all of this is worth it, that it's better to have a financial system that is clunkier, costlier, and more vulnerable to attacks than it is to have to trust someone, or more accurately, to admit that you have to trust someone. End quote. Using Bitcoin does not rely on trust in an individual. If you run a node, use a hardware wallet or a well-concealed paper wallet, and maintain good OPSEC, you are pretty much set. Of course, to obtain your Bitcoin, you may have to use Gemini, GDAX, or Square, but no one is forcing you to hold your Bitcoin on an exchange. It's only long-term storage on an exchange which requires significant trust in the institution, and Bitcoiners universally, vociferously encourage people not to do that. More broadly, Bitcoin doesn't remove trust entirely. That is a straw man frequently knocked down by critics. Bitcoin reduces the need for trust in a single institution. Instead, you just have to trust that the code is well vetted in the typical FOSS manner, and that the economics that underscore mining continue to hold, and that the discrete log problem is still hard. We have plenty of evidence that these things all hold and will continue to hold. And we have plenty of evidence that, conversely, a single institution in control of the money supply will always abuse its power. If you don't believe me, just check out what's happening in Turkey today. Seniorage is a drug, and it's pretty much impossible to kick the habit. Quote, Bitcoin exchanges require some measure of trust, whether they realize it or not. End quote. Centralized exchanges do. There exist non-custodial P2P exchanges like HODL and BISC for Bitcoin. Local Bitcoins is another peer-to-peer exchange that places reduced reliance on a single intermediary. Even centralized exchanges can conduct periodic proofs of solvency if users demand it. And as with the rest of finance, if the brokerages, exchanges, or clearinghouses are regulated under functional regimes, they are strongly incentivized not to run fractional reserve or lose user funds. The broader point here is that relying on centralized exchanges is inevitable. Many people will trade off decentralization for convenience, and we can't stop that. We can demand that exchanges behave appropriately. There are many exchanges and custodians with long histories of robustness, resilience, and integrity. There is a market for exchanges, and the badly run ones will fail. To sum up, the problem with this article is that the pundit in question has settled on a narrative. Bitcoin is a poor economic system, and then searched for various data points that confirm his view. Bitcoin is volatile, yes. It is an emerging commodity money that is becoming financialized and growing from a small tribe of enthusiasts to a global user base. Of course it's volatile. Growth is not linear. Only fragilistas demand it to be so. Nothing backs Bitcoin or pegs it to a basket of assets. Well, that's the point. Bitcoin was designed specifically to avoid the influence of a single authority. Bitcoin is priced exactly where it ought to be. This is always true. Manipulation might work on a 15-minute time frame, but it is just implausible in the extreme that a $100 billion asset class has been manipulated into existence. Yes, Bitcoin relies on exchanges to provide exit ramps for individuals that want to reduce their reliance on sovereign currencies. Sometimes those exchanges get hacked and fail. That is entirely natural. Bitcoin continues to chug along unaffected. It is extremely popular. Its strong assurances and settlement guarantees grant it daily volumes in the billions. It is a single order of magnitude behind Visa's economic throughput. That's right, just one 10x away. The gap will probably be closed in the next year. It has an unmatched record of reliability, resilience, and resistance to co-option. For a 9-year-old, that is a pretty good track record. If it was a human, it would be midway through the 4th grade. Pundits will continue to ignore this, not because they're incapable of reading the data, but because they don't want to. They are deeply afraid of the world that Bitcoin threatens to bring about. They prefer a paternalistic, easy money regime where occupations like punditry are profitable. Bitcoin promises accountability and a hard money standard. It threatens the existence of bailouts, moral hazard, and fiat inflationism. In Bitcoin land, the only way to acquire wealth is to work for it. Cronyism doesn't work, as the central bank of Bitcoin is entirely indifferent to politics and lobbying. This offends the sensibilities of the partisans writing for the Post. Bottom line, the central premise of the article is wrong. Quote, "There's one thing a currency is supposed to do that Bitcoin never has. That's maintain a stable value." End quote. Bitcoin isn't designed to have a stable value. That just quite frankly isn't what Satoshi set out to build, and that's not the system we have today. Artificial stability, or shorting volatility, leaves you destined for a blow-up. That is the fate of any non-fully backed stablecoin. Bitcoin is designed to solve the double spend problem for digital cash and to provide a predictable monetary policy. It does that very well, and it has done that for the last 9.5 years, and it will continue doing that for the foreseeable future. Demanding low volatility on top of that is farcical and betrays deep ignorance about the trade-offs inherent in monetary systems and the way that financial markets work more generally. Bitcoin is still an emerging, youthful asset. It hasn't reached maturity. It has somewhere in the realm of 50 to 100 million holders or users. That's global penetration of a percentage point or two. The base layer still hasn't been nailed down, let alone the next layers up on the stack. Development is deliberate and careful, because this is money we're talking about, not a consumer app. Governance is hard to organize. Consensus is difficult to obtain. The internet wasn't built in a day, and neither will the protocols for transmitting value trustlessly. Since the market is constantly revising its expectations for Bitcoin amid a backdrop of growing unsteady adoption, its exchange rate is volatile. No one is forcing you to hold it. It is totally opt-in. Bitcoin may not make sense for Westerners who live under somewhat credible monetary regimes, but it might be a good bet for an Iranian, a Venezuelan, a Turk, an Argentine, a Libyan, a Syrian, or an Egyptian. Really anyone that mistrusts their monetary authorities. Truthfully, mechanisms to bring Bitcoin to these disempowered groups are still lacking or non-existent. But they have the right to money that isn't controlled and minted by a hostile state. That is why Bitcoiners work to make global access to this economic institution a reality. Bitcoin's complexity doesn't acquit these pundits for getting simple facts about Bitcoin blatantly wrong, and ultimately their ignorance hurts their bottom line. Being amateurishly wrong about basic details of a system that is widely understood undermines their integrity and makes readers question their work. Mr. Bezos, a true capitalist, should understand this and demand more from his employees. All right, and that will close the article, again by Nick Carter. There's a couple of graphs that I didn't really get into because he basically says what the graph shows in the article and then shows the graph. Like, for instance, the fact that usage of the network grew substantially while the price was falling during the 2014 to 16 bear market. Then at the end, he's got a number of links to his own coinmetrics.io for open data and charting platform about actual usage of cryptocurrencies. He's a co-founder. BitcoinVisuals.com charts and visuals relating to Bitcoin and the Lightning Network. Then he links to Jameson Lopp's list of Bitcoin resources, Bitcoin's Academic Pedigree by Narayanan and Clark. That's an odd name. I don't know if I said that right. And then BitMEX Research, another, actually, I use that one pretty regularly. Actually, I pretty much use all of these except for the Academic Pedigree. I don't know that one. But BitMEX Research is long-form investigations into Bitcoin economics, the Tether mystery, and market dynamics. That's actually a really good... they have their BitMEX blog or whatnot, and it's really, really technical, but it's really, really solid information. It's one of the best technical breakdowns you can get, and I also use his service, coinmetrics.io, quite a bit. So there's really a lot of good stuff in the links provided in the article, so definitely don't forget to go check it out. and drop some serious applause on it if you liked this one. And I mean, if you want to read the Washington Post article, he basically hits all the main points, so it's probably not necessary, and it's a little cringeworthy. There's a lot of really nonsensical stuff in it. I mean, as you can see, it's just trying desperately to find reasons that Bitcoin won't work without any foundation into why their perceived negatives would even affect what Bitcoin is trying to solve. And it doesn't, obviously. You can see that by its history and by how and why people are using it. And then to add to that, it throws in a couple of economic fallacies to boot. First, that people won't use it because it's deflationary, which I hit rather thoroughly in my week of economics. The yield from money held is probably a really good one to hit on that topic. And the basic principle is just wrong. It's wrong for two very specific reasons. One, if we're talking about an inflationary money, you'd see the exact opposite thing happen with stable commodities. If you're inflating your currency and everyone can expect a commodity to have a higher price next year, well, then commodities would never get used for anything, which obviously doesn't happen. So the mirror argument is wrong and clearly fallacious. So obviously in the reverse, that during a deflationary system, that the money would never be used for anything is just as silly. For the same reason people still put gold and copper and silver and electronics and jewelry and all of these things, people will still use Bitcoin to spend it. Even more so is that there is the wealth effect that encourages them to spend it. If they had $100 and it turned into $1,000, suddenly they can afford things that they couldn't afford before. So they will use it, which pushes the price back down to the equilibrium price. And then the other major point is that all of this is compared against the value of time. They're completely ignoring one of the key and fundamental aspects of societal pricing, time value. I'll read their quote. Why spend $100 of Bitcoin today if you think it's going to be worth $1,000 in a not too distant tomorrow? You wouldn't, and people aren't. End quote. Well, that's ridiculous. There is a specific trade-off in time, and everybody runs out of time. Life expectancy for the best is like 78 years old. So if it's going to take 5 years for that not too distant tomorrow, which you don't know, no one has any guarantee. That's why people freak out during a 6-month bear market, is because all of this is unknown territory. Clearly, not everybody knows that Bitcoin's going to be worth $1,000 in the not too distant future or tomorrow. Specifically because here's the Washington Post saying it's not worth crap. So we're all disagreed on this. Nobody knows. And if that higher price target could be 5 years away, you think there's no cost in waiting? What is that? If you're 78 years old, that's like 6.5% of your entire lifespan to just wait for Bitcoin to be worth more? Like, This entire argument is essentially a rejection of the marginal utility of something. Is that it's worth more today, guaranteed in my hand, I know it will buy me a coffee, than it is 2 years from now, maybe it's nothing, maybe it's $1,000. It's so element, like it's such a cartoonish idea of economics to reject key economic axioms that are indisputable to just create some ridiculous narrative that deflationary currency means that people will never use it. It will fall into some infinite cycle of the demand being so high that nobody can ever use it for anything, which is the exact opposite of what high demand means. I'm utterly fascinated by how wrong this fallacy is and how persistent it is. I mean, granted, people aren't even exposed to it, so I get really worked up about it. But the deflationary spiral, nobody's going to use it because it's worth more tomorrow argument, is literally the Santa Claus of economic discussion. It could not be more imaginary. It has never happened in the history of the world. So that's that. Then it also basically just negates the fact that prices are meaningful in any way, shape, or form. That's basically the idea that volatility is unnatural or that volatility is a negative, is that the pricing mechanism is completely arbitrary and that it should just be set somewhere. Well, if market knowledge is not equal, if market usability is not equal, if different jurisdictions have different problems, if different environments come with different stressors, guess what? Prices will fluctuate with all of those different things into account. Prices are aggregators of millions, hundreds of millions of different transactions, individual valuations, knowledge bases, skill sets. All of these different things culminate in the market price of a good. Scarcities, demands, use cases, all of these things. So volatility is inevitable in particularly a new technology that few people understand, because knowledge bases have such wide gaps between them. Usability is so vastly different between someone who understands what it's for and who has no idea what they're talking about, like this person at the Washington Post. So there are so many factors that go into trying to find an equilibrium price in a new asset where everybody is ignorant and is just varying degrees of not knowing what's going on, that volatility makes perfect sense and is entirely inevitable, which Nick Carter, I think, explains pretty friggin' well in his article. So we will go ahead and end this one here, I think. There were no other major ones that I wanted to hit, just the two basic economic fallacy, which is really just the basis of, like, half of their claims are those two fallacies. The assumption, basically, that pricing mechanism doesn't mean anything, and that volatility is some thing to be, some evil to be dealt with, and that deflationary currency doesn't work, and people won't use it because of that. Those are both complete and utter nonsense, and they don't have any idea what they're talking about, so that'll be that. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed this one. Do not forget to check out Nick Carter. That's at @NIC_CARTER on Twitter and on Medium as well. A lot of great work. We've done article at least one or two, I think, by him in the past. Hasu Fly, who we've done an article for, I think, contributed to this article, maybe edits or something. For their feedback, yes. And Larry Suckernick as well helped out with the feedback. I don't know this name. I will check them out. But yes, don't forget to go to the article. Give it some applause. Check out the links. There's a lot of great stuff in here. And he produces good content very regularly. And obviously, I can't hit it all on the podcast. So outside of that, don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy. And at The Crypto Economy on Mastodon, which you can find me at the BitcoinHackers.org instance. You can also just find me on the Twitter page. On my Twitter page, you can see the link to go straight there. And of course, on Medium as well. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you can stay up to date on all these cool articles and the goings on in the crypto economy. We got a couple more chats lined up. There'll still be a little bit before I get those out, I think. I'm running a little bit of scheduling problems and a lot more work on the horizon. Still doing a lot in the background, and I hope to have things to announce in the near future. So keep an ear out, guys. Keep listening. And if you would like to support the show, I will always have my Bitcoin donation address available. Thank you guys so much for those who have donated. I did not notice that I had received a pretty hefty donation yesterday before I got the episode out. And thank you so much. That was a huge help. And it's really, really awesome to know that I'm providing value for somebody out there. So thank you, guys. It really means a lot. And the other way, obviously, is through my affiliate link. If you're finally getting around to getting your Trezor wallet or wanting to get a hardware wallet, Trezor is the way to go. Don't forget to save my affiliate link as your official Trezor store link, so that anytime you get the cool products from Trezor, you'll kick back a couple dollars my way and it won't cost you a thing. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. This has been the Crypto Economy Podcast, and I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode. Take it easy, guys.